From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the U.S. continues to slowly recover from recession, with unemployment at 7.4% and youth unemployment above 20%, the question comes again. Is studying the humanities a luxury for many that we can no longer afford? President Obama is pushing for more investment in STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math. Florida Governor Rick Scott wants universities in his state to charge less for engineering degrees. No mention of philosophy, English, history. The cost of a bachelor's degree has soared. Student debt is enormous. Is it wise to invest in that liberal arts degree? This hour On Point, debating the humanities. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you a humanities major? Would you do it again? Has it made you a better, wiser person? Have you found a job? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We've got a couple of strong defenders of the humanities who will be with us today. We go first to the argument of the anti-humanities camp, if I may call it that. With me from New York is Edward Conard. He wrote an op-ed essay for the Washington Post headlined, "We Don't Need More Humanities Majors." He's former managing director at Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's old outfit, and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Ed Conard, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What's the heart of your argument, sir? Socrates is rolling over in his grave.
I suppose he is. The way I would characterize the argument is, if we had one more H-1B visa to give, would we give that to a humanities major or would we give that to a technology and business major? And I think the criteria for that is what's best for the rest of society, particularly the middle class and the working poor. And I think if you go back and look, and I can cite statistics and we can do it over the course of the hour, but The U.S. has grown much faster than Europe and Japan. They've created many more jobs for both the middle class and the working poor. They've pulled 10 million immigrants into our workforce since 1996. We've put tens of millions of people to work offshore. And almost all of that differential growth has come from innovation, largely in the computer sciences and information technology areas. And that has been extremely beneficial for our middle class and working poor relative to Europe and Japan, the other high-wage economies. And those economies have shown just how difficult it is to grow employment in high-wage economies over the last two decades. And the U.S. has been singularly successful in this endeavor relative to the other high-wage economies, and it's largely come from business and technology and technological startups in the U.S., which have, if you look at, for example, the H-1B visas, account for a very high percentage, about a third of all the companies that have taken venture capital money and gone public over the last several years.
I guess nobody's against science, and technology has done a lot of wonders, but why go after the humanities, Ed? I mean, there is a long and noble tradition, goes back to the antiquity and the ancients and philosophy and history and literature and all the rest. I mean, we know we need that to kind of keep our compass settings as to not just what we're doing, but why and maybe where it's taking us. Why have you gone on the offensive against humanities?
I suppose the answer to that question is because I was asked to. I think there was a recent Harvard study, for example, by their humanities department trying to advocate that more Harvard graduates should take humanities rather than some of the other curriculum offered at Harvard, and that generated a fair amount of public debate, and then people have waded in on both sides of that debate, and I guess the Washington Post asked me to wade in on the technology side of the debate and try to put a counterbalance to the Harvard study that was out there.
Let's get that.
And at the same time, you also had the Rick Scott's comments in Florida that came a little bit earlier, but that added fuel to the fire.
Right. Let's get that debate going right here. We've got your kind of economic greatest good for the greatest number here. Let's get a bunch of startups, and we've got it. Joining me now in the studio with me in Boston is Mark Edmondson. He's university professor at the University of Virginia, teaches English and more, author of the new book, Why Teach? In Defense of a Real Education. He wrote an essay in the Washington Post headlined, "Why Major in Humanities? Not Just for a Good Job, for a Good Life." Mark Edmondson, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've just heard, in a nutshell, Ed Conard's argument that it's science people and technology people who drive economic growth, greatest good for the greatest number. I mean, yes, he was provoked to write it by the Washington Post, who needed the essay, but still he makes the case.
Yeah.
That's where we ought to be putting our emphasis. A few fewer humanities majors, so what?
Yeah. It was beautifully put, I have to say, but I was a little surprised when he said he didn't even believe it, really.
I didn't say
well,
that.
Well, I know I didn't hear him he quite asked, say well, that. He was asked to write it.
Anyway, it was beautifully put. I think this is an area where kind of idealistic arguments and practical arguments get together, you know? So when I think about why do people fail at their jobs, why don't things go well, I think one of the reasons often is they're in the wrong job. They're in the wrong place. They've followed out the wrong vocation. Now, if all goes well in a humanities education and we ask students the questions that Plato and Socrates told us to ask them, mm-hmm. they're going to leave school with a level of self-knowledge and a level of awareness about their own values and aspirations that's going to be superior to what most of their contemporaries have. And though there may be a bumpy ride coming out, they're
going to... First job, getting started, finding the career.
Tough, mm-hmm. But once they know what it is they're going to do, mm-hmm. then they know how to throw their energies into it and how to progress in the field. I mean, when I ask my friends, what mattered to you most about your college education? It's usually the moment I knew I was going to be a doctor, the moment I knew that I was going to be a journalist, the moment I knew that I was going to be interested in agriculture. And those things are often surprising to people, mm-hmm. and they come in classes, and particularly classes that involve the humanities. So self-knowledge, which is an ideal, can also be conducive to success. Now, I have more to say about it than that, mm-hmm. of a more controversial nature, but I think those things frequently do dovetail in ways that people can find very appealing. You've raised lots of other questions about cost,
sure.
et cetera, which we can get to.
We will.
But that's a start.
Ed, do you have anything against people starting in the humanities and then moving on in graduate education to something more focused? Maybe, I mean, of course, they won't all, and why should they? But I mean, do you have a fundamental problem with studying humanities, or is it just you want them to end up on a science track?
Well, I'd say science and business. I think the combination of the two are very important. I do think this, that Edison said that success is 1% perspiration. I mean, 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. I think I found a lot of people in business who've been successful through just a single-minded focus on accomplishing what it is they've set out to accomplish. And that if you actually look at studies of characteristics which determine success beyond simply a person's IQ or intelligence or capability, that open-mindedness actually reduces the probabilities of success. And so while I agree that it makes for a happier life, the evidence, the empirical evidence, is that it does not produce economic growth as successfully as things like conscientiousness and some of the other characteristics. But open-mindedness, which I think involves introspection and being more thoughtful, I think actually slows down the probability of companies helping their customers, which ultimately helps the middle class and the working poor.
But doesn't this get us to the very heart? I mean, what's life all about if you're going to give up open-mindedness and just focus on starting companies? Isn't that where the humanist comes in and says, what's the point here, Ed?
Well, I think you can certainly make ask that question. Did God create the universe so that the smart people could be happy, or did he put us on the earth to help our fellow man? And I don't mean to invoke God, we can invoke nature, but I would say that the talents of mankind are owned by mankind. They're not owned by the lucky recipients of mankind, and so are the investment opportunities that lie before us. And so talented people have a moral obligation to put those talents to work on behalf of their fellow man, as opposed to putting them up to work on behalf of themselves. So they can choose, and we do give everyone the freedom to choose, and they can choose to pursue things that are going to make them happier, or they can choose to pursue things that are more likely to help their fellow man. And I would contend to you that the latter, helping your fellow man, it may make you happy in some sense when you feel that you've accomplished it, but day to day when you're actually working on it, I think it's a tougher road to hoe.
Don't you see more to helping your fellow man than, I mean, job creation's great, but is that all there is?
Well, I think it's a rich man's argument. No, if you're rich enough, that's not all there is. But when you're living on $1.25 a day, 50% of the people in the world were living on $1.25 a day in 1980. Today, it's down to 20%. I really don't think they care about what the other things to life are. I think what they want is a little bit more money in order to be able to feed themselves and feed their families and live a better life. So, sure, at the level of the listeners to this radio program and the people who are debating this, there's all kinds of wonderful things that we'd like to enjoy in life. I think, unfortunately, the most people don't get to enjoy those things.
Mark Edmondson, there's a very, very stiff argument portraying the humanities as a luxury.
Right. I guess I'm still recovering from my mild shock about the polemic against open-mindedness. You know, down that road is fascism? What? So that's a little scary from my point of view. I did like the part, if I understood him correctly, about people pursuing lines of endeavor that help their fellow men and women. And as a teacher, I try to talk to my students about ideals. And I think of those ideals as the compassionate ideal, the ideal of courage, the ideal of contemplation, thought of a disinterested nature, and maybe, I'm not sure about it, the ideal of artistic creation. And I think these things are rewarding in themselves, but they also have an application to the enlargement of the lives of others, particularly in line with what Ed is saying, what one might call a compassionate ideal. I think most of us probably don't have the inner strength to reach for those ideals, but I'm trying to make them available to students. And part of the attraction is that when you do commit yourself to doing something that betters the lives of others, you somehow almost miraculously feel better too. And when you follow your own interests in a narrow way, it doesn't feel so good.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about studying the humanities, English, history, philosophy, more, majoring in the humanities in college, and the battle over whether it still makes sense in the 21st century economy, the battle over what the place of the humanities ought to be today. Ed Conard is here, former managing director at Bain Capital, left in 07, Mitt Romney's old outfit. Mark Edmondson is with us, professor of English and the humanities at the University of Virginia, author of Why Teach. And with us right now from New York as well is Max Neeson. He's a strategy reporter for Business Insider, wrote a piece called 11 Reasons to Ignore the Haters and Major in the Humanities in Business Insider. 24-year-old, graduated from Pomona College with a degree in economics. Max, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You've got 11 whole reasons to stick with the humanities in spite of what you call the haters. March us through your list quick, Max.
I don't think I'll get to the whole thing, but I'll definitely get a start. I think as the most recent graduate on here, as far as I know, I can't help but sort of take that perspective. And students are going to have to make the case to their parents who might be paying for their education and also sort of to themselves. I think the really big point to make is that you really do get a certain skill set from majoring in the humanities. You learn to write. You learn to think clearly. And that's something that that sort of education really excels at. It's about studying the ways others think and write. It's about writing yourself and getting detailed and critical feedback from someone who spent longer thinking and writing about a particular issue than you ever will. And that's really seriously valuable. Then the other side is that the economic picture really isn't nearly as bad as people seem to realize. The sort of common perception is that if you don't major in science or engineering or mathematics, you're going to end up jobless and are going to be pretty much hopeless. It's worth pointing out that the most unemployed college major is actually architecture, and the most underemployed major, the people who aren't working in a job that's quite up to their education level, is actually the undergraduate business major, because there are so many of them, and there aren't that many jobs unless you have an MBA. So although humanities majors are relatively underemployed or unemployed compared to engineers, the gap closes pretty quickly once you get a bit of experience, or particularly a graduate degree, once you have a couple of years to sort of figure out what you want to do and pursue that more doggedly.
What do you say to Ed Conard's argument that that's all very well, and if you can afford it, have it, but society overall is going to benefit more from having STEM grads who will go out and start companies and employ people, raise standards of living?
You know, I think the one really valid argument is very much student debt. If that's going to be a major concern for you, the salaries for someone who's an engineer are going to be much higher outside of school, and that's something that's definitely worth considering. But it's also worth considering your entire career. There are plenty of brilliant engineers out there that sort of stall out or can't quite sort of pursue innovation or get things done because they actually can't communicate an idea or relate to the people that they have to sell to or get them to invest in the idea. There's also the idea that being able to relate to people is something that's going to matter for your whole career. It's something that's a lot more transferable than, say, a very narrow scientific or computer science field. You can move that from to any company, and it doesn't matter how much technology advances. That's always going to be with you, how to write, how to talk, and how to sell.
Ed Conard, what about Mark Edmondson's argument that if you have a whole bunch of, I don't know, engineers or you name it running around without the humanities sort of guiding things, there's a real danger here. I mean, Hitler had a humming economy, but he ran it into a ditch. They lost their compass setting there. Isn't there that role for humanities students, Ed?
Well, I don't think, certainly my argument would not be that there's no role for the humanities whatsoever or that students wouldn't benefit by taking humanities courses, regardless of what major they're in. I think it's an issue of the trade-off at the margin. And if you look today, there's about 800,000 kids take advanced placement tests in history, in the literature and English, versus about 400 in calculus and statistics and 400,000 in physics, chemistry, and biology. The question then is, on the margin, do we need one more humanities major or one more math and science or business major? And so I don't think if the argument is, do we need any humanities majors? Of course we need humanities majors. Would students benefit from taking humanities and learning how to write and appreciate their fellow man more? Absolutely. The question is, on the margin, should we be doing more or less? And I think what you would find is that there are many, many more humanities and psychology and liberal arts majors relative to people who go into jobs that use those skills directly versus some of the other majors.
And that's
psychology would be a typical example. We have many, many more psychology majors than we have jobs for psychology majors.
That point is certainly out there in the public discourse. Here's a little tape of Florida Governor, Republican Rick Scott, on the Mark Bernier Show, saying that his state needs to spend more, not for more anthropologists, but for more STEM students, science, technology, engineering, math.
We don't need a lot more anthropologists in the state. It's a great degree if people want to get it, but we don't need them here. I want to spend our dollars getting people science, technology, engineering, math degrees. That's what our kids need to focus all their time and attention on, those type of degrees, so when they get out of school, they can get a job.
Where do we put our state support? Let's go to our callers, Jennifer in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks for calling, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I graduated with a philosophy degree 40 years ago and have been able nonetheless to be a successful individual and contribute to society. So I want to disagree that going into fields that make money, is a preferable way to go. When the gentleman said that, 20% of the world makes $1.50 an hour and we need to change this, I agree. And I think those changes have been made much more by people in the humanities and philosophy who are concerned about the ethics of helping others rather than making money intrinsically.
Well, there's an interesting point right there. Jennifer, let me ask you, has your philosophy study been central to your work, or has it simply been a foundation for your life? And
Well, both, actually. When I first graduated, I did have a lot of trouble finding work. I have to admit that. And I had several employers say to me in interviews, oh, what did you learn? How to think? Which says a lot more about them than it does about philosophy, when you think about it. But it has been a tremendous help to me, largely because I studied ethics, and I also studied how to question not just what other people were saying, but what I was thinking, and turn that around and think, what are the arguments against that, and what is a better way to achieve this? I spent 30 years running agencies that advocated for people with disabilities and worked on policy, and philosophy was definitely a tremendous help in being successful at that.
You know, one of the reasons we're doing this show is that we've had shows on student debt. And we would get calls from students saying, I majored in XYZ humanities, liberal arts, and I don't have a job, but I've got all this debt. And it raised the question about how widely it's appropriate in this economy for students. What's your answer to that one, Jennifer? Are we pushing some students into these majors who shouldn't be there? Or I suppose it's inevitable, but, do we need to pay attention to that?
It was different for me 40 years ago. I had student debt, but it was nothing of the magnitude that young people face now. I see the debt as a huge problem, but I don't think that just training for a job that will make money is the way to deal with that. I think looking at larger policy issues, the way the state of Oregon is, that's what we need to look at, not just saying, well, everybody give up on things that matter to you and go into a tech school or a job where you know you can make money.
Jennifer, I appreciate your call. Leon Wieseltier, at the his commencement address at Brandeis earlier this year, strong argument on that front. He writes, and this is sort of the other view, he says, we live in a society inebriated by technology and happily, even giddily, governed by the values of utility, speed, efficiency, and convenience, and, you know, pushing us to prefer practical questions to questions of meaning. He clearly wants both. He talks about resisting the twin imperialisms of science and technology. There's got to be a happy medium here. Will in Columbia, South Carolina. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Really, I wanted to call for two things. Basically, I graduated in 2000 with a degree in history, and I own my own business. I didn't do anything with my history degree. But what it did was it taught me, again, how to think, like some of your other callers have said. It taught me how to, the biggest thing I learned was people, where people were coming from, historically speaking, you know, their culture, their religion. And when I run into that in my business, I have a better handle of how to speak to them, how to deal with them. And I think that's all because of going to school and getting a degree in history. I didn't study business yet. You know, I don't feel that an MBA is necessary for everyone to be in business. I do value the almighty dollar, but I also am open-minded, and I value people's opinions and where they're coming from and what's important to them. So, I mean, I think there's room for both. Yes, we need to study science and math, and we need to be in the top in the world in that because, you know, we need to continue to progress. But I think it's a cop out to say that, oh, it's too expensive or it's too hard or what are the benefits. I've never, you know, people always succeed from working hard, and from continuing to learn no matter what it is. I think humanities are very important in that. That's basically what I have.
Will, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Ed Conard, what do you say there to Will, who says, look, I got a history degree. It served me fine. I've started my own business. I care about the dollar, but this isn't a bad way to begin, Ed.
Well, I don't think anyone's making the argument that there's no value in a history degree. There's obviously value in a history degree. The question is, where is there more value? And I think, keep in mind that today, I think more than 50% of the students are, tuition is subsidized by government aid. Close to half of them are receiving Pell Grants today. So the taxpayer is paying a large part of the bill for people to go to college. I think it's really the taxpayer who should decide what's in their benefit. Is it more history majors in their benefit, or are more technology majors in their benefit, which is likely to produce more jobs? And the other thing I would say is that, you know, we can talk about making earning money, or the buck is the almighty dollar. You know, by and large, and it's not 100% correlated, but people pay for what they want and need. And we serve our fellow man by serving customers and serving them as effectively as we possibly can. And people don't buy things that cost more than they're worth. They tend to buy things that are worth much more than they cost. And so we are all in this endeavor in business to try to produce more and more value for people at lower and lower costs, which is what rises people out of poverty. And I would remind the listener who talked, it's not $1.50 an hour. It's $1.50 a day.
Of course, it lifts people out of poverty if there's some kind of equitable economy being operated. Do the humanities play some role in that, in your view, Ed, in you know, sort of keeping values other than just profit in mind?
Right, absolutely. I think people are compassionate and they're merciful, and there are people who are in need, and striking the right balance between those two things is complicated and difficult. We don't know where the optimal balance is. We're constantly pushing and pulling on the margin on that balance, and certainly humanities contribute to helping us understand that issue.
Mark Edmondson, what do you say to the taxpayer who's contemplating this? There is a lot of taxpayer support for higher education in this country, not as much as in other developed countries, but it's there. What do you say? What's the fundamental argument you make to the taxpayer asking him or herself, do I want to be underwriting philosophy?
Well, it takes a book to say so. But in the long run, it seems to me that we, on our side of education, need to do all we can to lower costs of education, which are too high. As a society, we need to work with the loan system so that students aren't overwhelmed by it. And, you know, we need to be willing to commit ourselves to public education at an affordable and at a reasonable price. So there are a lot of steps that we academics need to take, and there are also a lot of steps that the general public needs to take in order to make this available. My objective as a teacher is to make the riches of the humanities available to more and more people, because I don't feel that they're a luxury acquisition at all. I really do feel that they're necessary in order to lead a good life.
Speak to that fundamental value of those studies. Ed goes very basic, very fundamental on the right. sort of business perspective on this. Mm-hmm. From the humanities representative side, speak to that fundamental value of these studies.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea that means central to the humanities is simple, two simple words, know yourself, right? And when we help our students to know themselves, they reach a point where they can determine what's best for them in their future lives, the kind of jobs they want to pursue, the kind of married life they want to pursue, the way they want to raise their children. And they also find out who they're going to be professionally and how they're going to pursue their profession so as to become, if they wish to be, successful. But I would add one more thing,
mm-hmm.
and that is that we in the humanities, and this may be a tad more controversial, we question everything, not just the government, not just schooling, but also terms like success, prosperity, money. And a student coming out of the humanities is likely to have thought seriously about the values of success, and he may ultimately have rejected them. It seems to me that we've kind of all been agreeing so far that success, monetary power, achievement of a middle class and more than middle class life is the greatest goal that an American can entertain. I'm not so sure, and the humanities put some students in a position to say no to those particular values. Others say yes to them, and I applaud it. I think that what you want is self-consciousness in life and an awareness to make the right kinds of decisions for yourself, just as you do in regard to government. You don't want those closed-minded people.
Do you feel the humanities under fire, under attack, this kind of utilitarian critique being rolled out in your life? Do you see it around the country? We heard the Florida governor there saying, look, I want to support engineering, not anthropology. Do you see a general I don't know if attack is the right word.
Yeah, I do. A little bit of it is our fault in the academy. We've turned inwards for a very long time, and we're good at talking to each other, but we're not so good at talking to the world at large and telling them about what it is we do and why. So there's a vacuum into which people who may not, for very good reasons, understand what it is we're trying to do as teachers, to step in and say, well, if you can't really explain yourself, I can explain myself. Ed explains himself very well. In Why Teach, I try to explain why the sorts of things that we do are valuable and probably more valuable than an exclusively technological education.
Ed Conrad, I know we have to let you go in just a minute here. If you could make a policy choice on American higher education, what would it be? Would you shift funds away from the humanities, Ed?
I probably would, in terms of how much I would be willing to subsidize people to get degrees that I think are less beneficial to society. I would remind everybody that 30 years ago, the U.S. supplied about 30% of all the world's college graduates. We were one of the first people to educate our people, and so we have our now college graduates are retiring relative to the rest of the world. So today, our net increase of the supply of college graduates is only 10%. And if you look at the scores, say the top math scores of our students, about 6% of our students are scoring in the advanced math scores, where it's highly correlated to economic growth. In Taiwan, it's 28%, Hong Kong and Korea, 20%, Japan, 15%. And so I think when we look forward into the future, we're going to see a future that's very different than the past, where in the past we had much more capacity to enjoy the humanities. And I think going forward into the future, we're going to have to make much tougher choices about how to educate our most talented people.
Ed Conrad, great to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us from New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about studying the humanities, English, history, philosophy, more, majoring in the humanities in college, and the battle over whether That still makes sense in the 21st century economy. For whom? Mark Edmondson is with us, author of Why Teach? In Defense of a Real Education, university professor at the University of Virginia, with me in the studio today. From New York, Max Neeson is here, strategy reporter for Business Insider, 24-year-old graduate of Pomona, degree in economics there. He wrote a piece headlined 11 Reasons to Ignore the Haters and Major in the Humanities. Humanities graduates can express themselves, one of those reasons, and do it well. Got lots of response here online. Let me just cite some of it. Here's Dan writing to us on Facebook, says, the problem is the either-or mentality. STEM majors need more humanities. Humanities majors need more STEM exposure. Dan writes, I have an undergraduate degree in STEM, science, technology, but I'm going back to study the humanities. Okay, a little of both. Dwayne says, at work, I can tell the difference between humanities and non-humanities colleagues. The latter are less imaginative, tend to be myopic. Okay, there's real fighting words. But here's Jeff, on the other hand, says, I found most humanities majors are typically the most closed-minded. They get the liberal indoctrination, and if you disagree with that ideology, they will shut you out and call your names. I find people with STEM majors can analyze and discuss all issues with a more open mind. Tamia Karen reminds us, though, this is on Twitter. Hey, it was Steve Jobs' liberal arts design background that made Apple products so successful. There's that perspective. Let's go to Liz in Norfolk, Virginia. Liz, thanks for calling. What's your experience?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I actually graduated in 2011 with a degree in English, and my emphasis was in creative writing. Okay. And my comment was just that I have about half of the student loan debt than that of, like, my friends and you know, counterparts my age, because I chose something that I loved, and in turn, I actually earned a bunch of scholarships and graduated top of my class because I was so in love with my major, and, you know, so passionate about it.
Good
so
for you.
I actually end up paying less than, you know, a lot of people that I know with engineering degrees and things of that nature because I loved it and enjoyed it so much.
So your advice, or can you give advice across the board to somebody looking at selecting an undergraduate degree right now?
Absolutely. Choose something that you love and you know, something that you're passionate about, and it makes it so much easier to succeed.
Liz, I appreciate your call. Congrats on that top performance. Sarah in Columbia, Tennessee. Sarah, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You posed a question recently, you know, can we afford to major in humanities, and as a person with a bachelor's and a master's in creative writing and fine arts, the question for me is, you know, could I afford not to? You know, I did have a lot of external forces, you know, encouraging me to do nursing or, you know, something where I would most definitely have a job as opposed to, you know, writing poetry, which we all know does not pay, even if you're very successful. And ultimately, I followed my heart, like our previous caller. Mm-hmm. And this entire conversation, for me, is a very spiritual conversation. Adam said, where is there more value? And I think that it ultimately it boils down to how do we as individuals and society define value? You know, bottom line is not money. The bottom line for me is definitely spirit. And, you know, I think it's up to each individual to follow their own passion and, you know, hopefully they will have it within themselves to do that.
What about, I totally appreciate and admire that. But let me just ask about the economic equation behind it. Lots of people come out with a lot of debt. I don't know about your case, Sarah. I mean,
yeah.
That's a real thing in life. It can be a real weight on one shoulder. How's that work for you?
Well, I actually have slightly over $100,000 in student loan debt, so I understand that. I'm also currently unemployed, and so I understand the stress of money and student loan debt, but, you know, I'm also getting my poems published and working towards my dream, you know, what I feel like I've been chosen to do, and I have good days and I have bad days, but I don't regret you know, anything.
Sarah, you've got a lot of steel. We'll classify you in the stoic category there with that debt load, and we'll wish you very good luck. I appreciate your call. One more right here, Jack in New Orleans. Jack, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I'm currently a MD PhD student in New Orleans, and I can say
MD PhD, like medical doctor PhD.
Correct.
Okay.
And I was fortunate enough to study philosophy, politics, and economics at Claremont McKenna in undergrad, and I can tell you that the teachers I had, especially in philosophy and political science, helped so much shape the way that I view medicine and science today, and have given me the opportunity to really address some of the major issues that that we run into in medicine. And I think while we are super fortunate in the U.S. to have the ability to go after humanities education, maybe more so than other places, I think while we do have that opportunity, we should take it. And that's about all I have.
Jack, that's a great deal. I appreciate your call. Max, there's a graduate from a sister school to your Pomona. What about employers? Here Jack is putting together a pretty good package for himself. You know, humanities undergrad, MD, PhD, he should do all right. What about employers in general? How do they look at the different strands of degrees when it comes time to hire?
I think there's definitely a tendency for them to sort of prefer the STEM majors just because those are some skills that you can apply immediately. I would counter with the fact that if they're facing a lack of technical talent, they should think more about hiring a lot of the extremely bright and personable liberal arts graduates that I actually know and investing in training them. That's one way that they can sort of close the gap.
What's the argument there? You'd like them to hire your buddies, but what's the argument for it?
Sure, absolutely. So there are a couple ways they can go about it. They can either pay a massive premium for an extreme shortage of technically competent workers. They can pay them six figures for some developers outside of school. That's actually not unheard of. Or they can invest in sort of taking some really bright people that might have studied something else and putting some time and money into teaching them the skills that they most want and need.
Pick up humanities majors on the cheap and then turn them into programmers or something. Oh, boy. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is something that I actually feel pretty strongly about. I'm going to borrow a quote. This is a friend of mine who's a journalist. He's spending a lot of time on his own learning to code.
Yeah.
If you focus entirely on computer science or engineering, you might be very well compensated, but you're just another developer. You're one of many. But if you're in another field or you're in another major and you can sort of speak that language, you can code a little bit, you really are exceptional. And I think we should work on creating some more of those people.
Hey, Mark Edmondson, what about this hybrid model? I mean, no small part of higher education descends to us from a time when it was the privilege to have that education, where it was the realm of a kind of, genteel class. What about this humanities twinned with? I mean, in Max's friend's case, it's coding. In Max's case, it's coding. What about putting these together? Your philosophy major who goes out and picks up some STEM capacity.
Couldn't be better or more enjoyable. Some of the very best and most interesting students I have are coming in from the engineering school. They're majoring in physics. They're going on to medical school. And they're very curious and very open. And they know what they want out of the humanities. They want to ask some big questions. They want to see if they can't begin answering them. And they are a pleasure to have around, and they tend to be not only very successful, but they also tend to be very happy in their lives. So I'm always pleased to see them coming.
Lisa in Waitfield, Vermont. Lisa, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question that I'd like someone who is advocating for a very large percentage of students to attain STEM-related degrees to answer.
Okay.
And my question is, what will be the nature of the work that the people will actually be doing?
Well, we don't have Ed Conard with us at the moment, so unfold more of your inquisition here so we can understand where you're going, Lisa.
I'm concerned that for a lot of people, they will end up sitting in front of a computer terminal all day long by themselves, entering data or manipulating data to benefit somebody else. And I have a lot of nieces and nephews for whom I would not wish that career, and I'm concerned that it's going to become like a factory worker was maybe 50 or 100 years ago.
Yeah. Lisa, I appreciate your call. Max, I've seen the argument made that some of these STEM jobs, unless they're very high tier, may be like factory jobs of a generation ago, the most exportable, the most vulnerable in that way yet, Max.
That's what I think the core point here is, that the ultimate goal should be to create a country where everyone can pursue what they're interested in and good at. If that happens to be a STEM field, then pursue that particular STEM field. That's the best way you can avoid that sort of job. The way that we can make more of that sort of unfortunate situation is by pushing people into a STEM field when they might not be inclined or interested. And then they don't learn that much. They don't particularly excel in it unless they're one of those unique people that can, you know, succeed in anything they put their mind to. I think that the way to really avoid that is just do our best to let people pursue what they're passionate about. And it's great if it's STEM. And I don't think that people that have a wonderful passion for computer programming are going to end up doing data entry all day and being miserable about it.
I guess it all defines what you consider misery. Lisa may define coding as misery. I don't know. Andy in New Orleans. Andy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. I have a background that is in the liberal arts. I'm a full-time professional artist. And I was on a career path that was set by the status quo in my field, which was generally by professors to make you a professor, meaning that without the actual academic job at the end of that rainbow, you really didn't have a chance to make a living doing it. And I was blessed enough to have made a decision that went professional, almost as though you're a golfer, an Olympic athlete. You take the route of amateur and you can stay within the Olympics, or if you ended the private sector, you go in that direction. And what I've found consistently after 26 years of doing this is that the academic end of it is actually in itself a trap. And it's a trap almost like a cult in which you have professors only training those to make a living being another professor. These degrees need to be continued on. You find yourself, this cult sells you into it, and before you know it, you're all with student loan debt, and you're just traveling from university to university looking for an adjunct job instead of actually doing some, you know, doing a viable living. And I ask you, I'm preaching to the choir on this. I'm not disvaluing the value of the humanities, but I think the delivery device needs to be changed, and it needs to adapt to this digital age where somebody can use these critical thinking skills, which are so critical in getting, and that's to make the value of them, to actually earn a living off of it, a living wage, and not just ending up back in the academics, treating the, you know, teaching the next generation of academics.
Andy, we've got it. I mean, we clearly need teachers. We need next generations of teachers. But what about Andy's concern, complaint that humanities can turn into some of their more rarefied fields, perhaps, Mark, can turn into professors, educating professors?
Maybe a little hyperbolic, but a good point buried in there, it seems to me. In English departments, we sometimes, from my point of view, assign too much literary critical analysis, which is what we do as professors, rather than asking for people to appreciate works, imitate works, and ask if there are available human truths, either submerged or immediately available in them. So that we got to take a look at the tensions between being professional critics and being teachers. And I would like it a lot if we move more in the direction of being teachers and thought of ourselves as being teachers to our students, and also, so far as anybody wanted to listen, to this, the culture at large. And I think then we'd step out of some of the problems that are being alluded to there, maybe in a little bit too technicolor way, but they're real. They're there.
Max, you know, there's also the issue of our economy not being what it once was. And people who say, look, you know, it's great, the humanities are fantastic, but there's this luxury angle to it that, of course, we need them, but we can't afford to send as many young people into those fields today as we once did. It's just a different time. What do you say to that, Max?
You know, I think there's a bit of a fair point there, but the biggest problem I see with the argument that we should emphasize STEM over the humanities is that we're already doing it pretty effectively. The vast majority of federal research funding actually goes to STEM fields.
Mm-hmm.
So many public institutions that are already sort of under budget pressure from their state, they're going to cut those humanities programs first because their science professors can get federal grants, can get outside sources of funding. So that's one thing. The program, the humanities programs aren't as good at a lot of schools. That's pushing people away from them. And there's also really the salary and employment numbers. That's going to put a lot of pressure on people. So I don't think that there's some issue where we have too many humanities majors that we're pushing people in that direction. I think that the reality of the economy and the market is doing it pretty effectively on its own.
Mark Edmondson, how do you see it ultimately? Humanities holding their own or in a defensive posture here? Are we losing something in our urgency to find economic success?
I think that's a very well taken point. There's a lot of talk about success and prosperity and making money and paying debts, and I'm sensitive to it and responsive to it. But there isn't a lot of talk in the culture right now about what it might mean for young people who were devoted to a particular subject or a particular passion to see what they could do to live with less. I'll speak only of my son who lives in Austin, Texas, and lives in a very inexpensive apartment and works a few days a week fixing and building bikes so that he can follow his passion, which is the writing of fiction. Would it ever make him a lot of money? Maybe. He just wrote a really terrific novel from my point of view. But he was happy to trade living with less for the ability to have more freedom. And, you know, I'd like to hear more about that in the world at this point. There are difficulties, but I'm not hearing enough about it.
Mark Edmondson, university professor at the University of Virginia, author of Why Teach, with us today with his defense of the humanities. Professor Edmondson, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. Very kind of you to have me.
And Max Neeson, reporter at Business Insider in New York. Max, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow, in this hour, we will look at the great album by jazz great John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, and the legacy of that album in American arts and music. On Point is produced by Emily Alphen Johnson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Abigail Collins, Dori Rabar, Christina Russo, Imogene Weinstein. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.